About quantum circuits. So now we have a model in mind that we could, in principle, try to use to come up with quantum algorithms. So maybe that would be the natural next thing to do. But actually, today we're going to take a little break, and we're going to talk about ways that you would actually implement these quantum circuits. So how you would actually, you know, possibly build something in the lab that would realize this model of quantum circuits. And I think maybe this will be, well, hopefully this will be helpful so that you have something in mind when we're thinking about quantum algorithms, so you can imagine, you know, how you would actually build a device that would implement these systems. So this is, I guess, the only lecture where we'll really talk about these kinds of, implementation details, but maybe it's good to just say a little bit about this. So what we're going to do is talk about these criteria, which are called the DiVincenzo criteria, which are sort of some guidelines for what you might like to have in a good candidate application of quantum information processing. And then I'll talk about an implementation that you might, at least in principle, try to build, which would be based on nonlinear optics. And I have to say that this is not a leading candidate in practice. It's, you know, something that you could imagine doing in principle, but it seems to be too demanding from a technical point of view to actually be a good way to build a quantum computer. But I'm going to describe this way of thinking about implementations because it's conceptually quite simple, and it will show you sort of the kinds of things that you have to look for when you try to design an implementation. And then at the end, I'll give kind of a brief summary of some of the leading implementations and what maybe some of their strengths and weaknesses are. OK, so any questions before we get started? Anything from last time? Or yes? Do I have hints as to how to implement the OR with AND and NOT? So this is what goes by the name of De Morgan's laws. Well, so, you know, one thing I could say is this. I mean, basically, you have to combine, you know, NOT gates and OR gates in some way. NOT gates and AND gates in some way to get an OR gate. I mean, the natural thing to do would be to try, you know, maybe just use one OR gate and negate some of the inputs and some of the outputs. Well, there's only one output, so possibly negate the output. And, you know, there's only a few possibilities, right? So there's only 8 things to try. So you could just try them all, and maybe you would find that one would work. I'm not sure that I can really. I mean, if you've seen these De Morgan's laws before, then you would just sort of know what to do. But if you just wanted to try to do it by brute force, that strategy would certainly work. Is that okay? Okay. All right. Good. Other questions? Okay. Good. All right. So I want to talk about these DiVincenzo criteria. So, you know, this is not like somehow necessary and sufficient criteria for what you would need to have to build a quantum computer, but it's just, you know, some kind of list of some things that we would probably like to have. And sometimes there are ways around these criteria. You know, it might be that that you could implement one of the things that the criteria say you have to implement in a surprising way. So you might have to think outside the box when you think about what it means to implement these criteria in some system. But they give you at least some place to start thinking about what you might need in order to build a quantum computer. So I mean, I should say on the general subject of implementations, you know, the landscape of possible implementations is complicated because, you know, we haven't been trying that long to try to build quantum computers. I mean, it may seem like, you know, it's been maybe 20 years or something like that people have been thinking seriously about quantum information processing, but that's not really that long in the grand scheme of things. I mean, if you think about how long it was from when people first started thinking about the idea of doing computations in some mechanical way, you know, for example, when Turing was thinking about Turing machines, you know, it was a long time before we had practical large-scale digital computers, you know, certainly more than 20 years. So I think we're still in the early days. So, you know, we don't have a single implementation that we think is clearly going to be the best implementation the way we do now for classical computers, right? I mean, the classical computers that we use are basically all built using transistors that are fabricated on silicon chips, and there's a, you know, very specific way that the architecture of computers is put together, and there's no reason, you know, in principle that it has to be that way, but that just turns out to be a good way to build computers in practice. And we don't have kind of an analog of that for quantum computers, you know, a single way that seems like it's clearly going to be the best, and we've put a lot of, you know, thought into really refining specific technologies for building computers in that way, we're just thinking about the landscape of all of the different possibilities. And so there are many, you know, many different candidates to think about, and that's why we have to kind of go through different possible physical systems that we might use and think about what criteria do we need to satisfy in order to have a system be a good candidate for a quantum computer. Okay, good. So here are these DiVincenzo criteria. Okay, so the first thing we're going to need to do is we're going to need to represent quantum information in some way. So we're going to need to have some way of storing information. So without loss of generality, we can think about that, about doing that using qubits. And so that's what the first criterion says. So we should have scalable, well-defined qubits. So what I mean by scalable, well, what David DiVincenzo meant by scalable was that, you know, you should not just be able to build one qubit or two qubits, but if you want to build n qubits for any n, you should have some kind of procedure whose difficulty scales reasonably with n. So it shouldn't, for example, scale exponentially with n. You should be able to, you know, in principle, manufacture a system with arbitrarily many qubits, using, of course, more work to make more qubits, but not an unreasonable amount of additional work to make more qubits. So you would like the system to be scalable, and you would like it to consist of individual qubits. So it's important that the Hilbert space of the system that you think about, consists of some kind of tensor product of local systems. So the idea is that these qubits should be, described by some degrees of freedom that you can sort of combine using a tensor product structure, and that allows you to have the potential for the scalability. So you can just add on more and more systems, and this allows you to, in principle, build some arbitrarily large system. Okay, so for example, to maybe say what would be a kind of thing that would not satisfy this criteria, so a bad thing to do, would be, for example, you could, maybe you have a hydrogen atom, right? So you have infinitely many electronic states. You could put the electron, in one of arbitrarily many levels. So in principle, this would let you store, arbitrarily many qubits of information, right? If you have 2^n different levels, this would allow you to store n qubits. Okay, but this is not a scalable system because you're not building up the qubits with some tensor product structure. Right, so a better implementation maybe of a qubit would be something like a two-level system. So like a spin or the polarization degree of freedom of a photon or something else. This would be a reasonable way to implement a qubit. And then if you wanted to have many qubits, you could have many spins, for example. Now, of course, it's not necessary that you have some system that only has two levels. You could have, for example, a subspace, so a two-dimensional subspace of a larger system. So, for example, we could take, electronic energy levels. So, for example, we could take a hydrogen atom and only use the ground state and the first excited state as our two levels. And then if we wanted to have many qubits, we could have, more hydrogen atoms. But we wouldn't just want to use one atom for our entire quantum computer. Or we could use, for example, number states of some harmonic oscillator, but then only use, say, the ground state and the first excited state, or something like this. Okay, so this is what we would want to have in terms of our implementation of qubits. Okay, now I have to remember what order I decided to present these in. Okay, right. So the second thing is that we would like to initialize our system to a pure state, right? So, we can think back to the circuit model. This is what we're trying to implement. We initialize our system initially with all of our qubits, say, in the zero state, and then we perform computation using gates, right? So the next thing we have to do after having, in principle, these qubits lying around is we have to be able to initialize them. So initialize qubits to a pure state, say the all zero state. Okay. Now, I should say, of course, there's going to be some leeway in some of these requirements. So it's not absolutely necessary that you literally be able to prepare your system in a pure quantum state, completely decoupled from its environment, because you know, I mean, if we had to do that, we would never achieve that, you know, that kind of perfection in some realistic system. So really, we just need some kind of good enough approximation to this. So, you know, then you'll have to think about how well do you have to approximate the situation, and this kind of thing we'll talk about when we discuss error correction and fault tolerance. So, but, you know, it is in principle okay if you prepare your system in a slightly mixed state, but you have to be careful about situations where you might prepare the quantum computer initially in some highly mixed state, because this can really lead to problems with scalability and with the possibility to do long computations efficiently. So this is a problem which arises, for example, in nuclear magnetic resonance implementations of quantum computing, which I'll say something about later on at the end. Okay. So probably the next thing is that we have to be able to do a universal set of quantum gates. Yes, so we should be able to do a universal set of quantum gates on our qubits. So we talked about universality yesterday, and we said our circuit model would be one that would consist of a universal set of gates. And I mentioned that there was one particular universal set of gates, which consisted of the CNOT gate, the Hadamard gate, and the pi over 8 gate. But that was just one example. Of course, you know, any universal gate set would be fine. And actually, so there's a theorem that I didn't have time to mention yesterday, but which is called the Soloveitchi-Katayev theorem, which basically says that any finite set of universal quantum gates is equivalent to any other. So there's some technical requirement that the gate set should be closed under inverses, but if you don't worry about that, I mean, what that theorem basically says is that if you have any universal set of gates, that can simulate any other with only a logarithmic overhead. So the overhead in simulating one universal set of gates with another is quite small, and for that reason, we don't really care so much about what is the particular choice of universal gates that we have in our particular implementation. So that's nice because, you know, when you try to come up with an implementation, it might be more natural to do certain kinds of gates than others in a particular implementation, and you have the freedom to choose whatever is most convenient for you. So, you know, of course, we need to do, when we do this, we need to be able to do some kind of single qubit gates, and we need to be able to do some kind of interactions. And there are different ways that these gates can arise. You know, for example, in some systems, the system that you're considering may just naturally have some interactions that are on all of the time. And so the interactions may in some sense come for free. Or you may have to actively manipulate the system to create interactions. So certainly the details of this will depend on the particular implementation that you use. But you need to have some kind of universal set of gates at your disposal. Okay. So then we need to be able to measure our qubits, and it's really important that we be able to go in and measure specific qubits, that we not just be able to measure some kind of collective degrees of freedom of the whole system. So we want the ability to measure specific qubits. Actually, it would be good enough for the purpose of solving decision problems. So if we were trying to solve some problem where the answer was just yes or no, it would be good enough to measure only one qubit if we just use that qubit to write the final answer of the computation. Although in order to do fault-tolerant computation, it will be important that we be able to measure qubits actually during the course of the computation in order to sort of flush entropy out of the system. So this is something that we'll be talking about later on. So while in principle it would be enough to, you know, sort of defer all the measurements of the computation to the end, and maybe that would actually only involve measuring one of the qubits to read out the final answer of the computation, in practice, if we want to make things fault tolerant, we will have to actually be able to measure specific qubits during the course of the evolution. Or you know, at least be able to prepare qubits in zero states over the course of the evolution. I guess if we can do that, then it would actually be okay to defer our measurements. Okay. Actually, while I'm on the subject of fault tolerance, maybe I should mention one other thing that is maybe relevant to this question of a universal set of quantum gates, which is that there are different ways that you could be able to perform gates. It could be that you can only perform one gate at a time, say, on one qubit or maybe on some pair of qubits. And that's actually not sufficient. So actually, in order to be able to do fault-tolerant computation, it will be necessary that you can do operations in parallel. So, So maybe I'll just make a remark about that here. So we need to do gates in parallel for fault tolerance. And again, we'll talk about fault tolerance later on in the last week of the course. But since it does come into these issues of, you know, how would you choose a good implementation, I want to at least preview some of these things now. OK. So we have to be able to measure specific qubits. And then the last thing is that, you know, of course, there will be errors in the system. So I mentioned this, you know, briefly in the context of state preparation. But it will be the case in all of the operations that we do, right? I mean, we'll have errors in our preparation. We'll have errors when we do gates. And we'll have errors potentially, you know, when we make measurements. I mean, any realistic system will have these errors. And so we need to be able to tolerate these errors. And, you know, in particular, if we think about the errors that happen in the gates, of course, most of the computation consists of doing these gates. So this is where there's the biggest potential for these errors to creep in. You know, there's going to be some noise happening all the time. And you can think about this as being characterized by some decoherence time. So there's some characteristic time for the system to become noisy. And there's also some characteristic time that it takes to do a gate, which could be different maybe for the single qubit gates and the interactions. But there's some, say, longest time that it takes to do a gate. And so certainly a necessary condition would be that you can do, you know, a lot of gates before the system becomes completely noisy due to decoherence. So you need to have gate operation times that are short compared to the decoherence time. And there's some kind of, you know, fundamental tension here that you have to worry about when you're coming up with any implementation, which is that, you know, we're trying to have our system be kind of very well isolated from its environment, right? Because decoherence arises because the system interacts with its environment. You know, the degrees of freedom of the computer become entangled with the degrees of freedom of the environment. And this effectively leads to decoherence when you think only about the system consisting of the computer. And so, you know, the system, we would like to be very weakly coupled to its environment, but at the same time, we need to be able to control it, right? We need to be able to choose which gates we're doing at any particular time. So we need to couple to the system, and different pieces of the system need to couple with other pieces of the system. So we have to have certain couplings which are very strong, you know, the couplings that describe this these gate operation times, and other couplings, the couplings to the environment, we want to be weak. And getting these two things to happen at the same time is, you know, part of the difficulty of building a quantum computer. So, you know, in any implementation, you have to sort of fight against these things. And what you typically find is that, you know, there will be systems in which the time it takes to do a gate is naturally faster. But in those systems, they're actually, you know, typically will tend to be also faster decoherence. So you have to kind of try to find a sweet spot where you can do, you know, gates as fast as possible and have the decoherence time be as long as possible. And there's a lot of you know, art and engineering and, you know, careful thinking that goes into finding a system that will really satisfy this requirement. And in some sense, this is, you know, maybe the hardest part of trying to build a quantum computer. Okay, so questions about these kind of basic criteria? Yes. Well, of course, it depends on what is the specific implementation that you're looking at. But, you know, kind of what I was just saying was that, you know, this issue of trying to, you know, have a system that you can control very well, but that doesn't couple to its environment very strongly, I mean, this is certainly something which is quite difficult. You know, in some sense, you know, for example, if you look at criterion 3, right, you know, we need to have a universal set of gates, and you can't really say that you're doing the gates unless you can do them very precisely. So unless you can do them fast compared to the decoherence time. So in some sense, you wouldn't say that you had really satisfied this condition until you had satisfied this one. You know, so measurement, you know, of course, it depends on the specific system. In some cases, the measurements can be done faster than others, or more accurately than others, and it really will just depend on the details. So there are some systems where maybe this can be done quite well, and others where you know, it can't be done as well. And you really have to look at the specific implementation. I mean, we'll have to look at specific systems before we can really say, you know, whether these criteria are met or not. I think, yeah, maybe it's not helpful really to talk, you know. I don't think I can say, you know, this is the only thing we have left to do. I'm just saying that this is a big challenge, and it's certainly a big part of the difficulty of building a quantum computer. So, yes.
According to my understanding, there's this separation between the first five criteria and the final two about flying in stationary conditions. What system would you say the flying in stationary criteria are meant to apply to?
Yeah, so I wasn't actually going to mention this, so I guess you've either read this paper or you've seen something about this before. So, you know, in this paper where David DiVincenzo laid out these criteria and he said, you know, here's some things to think about if you want to try to build a quantum computer, you know, he also talked about what criteria you might like to have if you wanted to communicate between different computational units. And so, you know, then you would like to have what he called flying qubits that you could use to transfer data between different quantum processors. And, you know, there were two additional criteria which were, you know, I guess basically that you should be able to couple, you know, these qubits, these stationary qubits in the quantum computer to these flying qubits, and then you should be able to send the flying qubits wherever you want. And these are additional criteria that you would think about, you know, basically if you wanted to be able to send quantum information between different quantum computers. But we're, you know, for the most part here, we're going to just be talking about quantum computation in a single quantum computer, which is really hard enough to do. I mean, that's enough of a challenge already. So we're just going to focus on that for most of the course. Okay, was there another question? Okay, good. So the next thing that I wanted to do was talk about a specific implementation, you know, in order to see what happens with these criteria when we you know, look at some specific system. And so the system that I wanted to think about was nonlinear optics. All right, good. So the idea here is, well, okay, so what we're going to do basically is we're going to try to kind of you know, describe some physical system in which we could imagine doing a computation, a quantum computation, and we would like to see that we can satisfy all of these criteria, or at least understand what it would take to satisfy all of these criteria. So the first thing would be to understand, you know, what degrees of freedom we could use to describe the qubits. So what we're going to do is we're going to store information in optical modes. We'll have, you know, light, which is created with some kind of a laser source. And, you know, I guess you know all about, you know, harmonic oscillators and how you would describe such systems. So these will be described by creation and annihilation operators. You know, A dagger and A, right? So we have some system which has a set of basis states corresponding to the number of excitations in the mode. So we think of this as the number of photons in the mode. So, you know, to remember how this goes, so A dagger acting on N is, I guess, the square root of N plus 1, and A acting on N is the square root of N minus 1. Okay, so these are the usual kind of ladder operators for the harmonic oscillator. So we think about our system as being described by these number states, where we have some number of photons n, and then, you know, we have these operators that we can use to think about creating and destroying photons. Okay. So now what are we going to do? Well, we would like to have some way of storing a qubit. So, you know, what we said before was we could, for example, store a qubit in some two-dimensional subspace of a larger system, right? We don't want to just have the possibility of having, you know, between 0 and 2 to the n minus 1 photons. That would be a very non-scalable way to try to do things. So instead, what we'll do is for a single mode, we could store a qubit using the possibility of having either 0 or 1 photons there. So we could store a qubit in a mode with the states 0 and 1, which, you know, conveniently are exactly, this is exactly the same notation that we used before to represent a qubit. Of course, you know, there are these other states of the optical mode that we just don't use. So, you know, we would say that we don't use the states 2, 3, et cetera, right? So these states weren't there before. Now they're there, but we're just not going to use them, okay? So this would be a way of storing a qubit where we have, you know, the state 0 and 1, and then we could have any superposition of those two states, and then that would give us the state of a qubit. Okay. But there's actually a problem with this. Because if we wanted to try to, you know, store quantum information in this way, the next thing we're going to have to do, eventually something we're going to have to do, would be to make a state where we have, say we have a zero state and we want to perform a NOT gate. We want to send that to the one state, and that would mean that we would have to create a photon. So we would have to add a photon to the system, and it'll be much easier to think about the kinds of operations that we have to do if we actually conserve photon number in the whole system, if we don't have to create or destroy any photons in the operation of the computer. So that would be nicer if we could get something that did that. And there's a pretty simple way to do that. So to have an encoding where the logical operations preserve photon number, what we're going to do is we're going to use what's called a dual rail encoding. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're actually going to have two modes that describe the state of a qubit, and we're only going to use the states 0, 1, or 1, 0. Okay, so we have two modes, and we'll say 0, 1, this is going to be the logical zero state, and 1, 0 will be the logical one state. So these are two, you know, distinguishable states of a pair of modes. And, you know, crucially, they have the same number of photons in both of them, right? This one has one photon, and this one has one photon. So now, you know, our entire space of logical states consists of single photon states, and then we could do, you know, X operations or Z rotations, or we could do any kind of operations that we like, and we would always stay within the subspace of states that have one photon. And now if we want to have, you know, if we want to have n qubits, we just have two n modes, right? So we just have a pair of modes to represent every qubit. And of course, we'll have to think about how to do gates on such things. But you know, that's at least some encoding where when we try to do gates, we won't have to be creating or destroying any photons. Yes?
Similar to the earlier suggestion of using a hydrogen atom, but there we didn't like it at least. We used it earlier as a bad example, the hydrogen atom, the energy level.
Right, so you know, the analog here, which would be a bad idea, would be to just have one mode and then use, you know, 2 to the n possible states of that one mode. So say you have any number of photons between 0 and 2 to the n minus 1 in that one mode, you know, potentially exponentially many photons in that one mode to describe the 2 to the n possible distinguishable, you know, classical basis states. And then we need to have superpositions, arbitrary superpositions of them. But notice that here we only need n photons if we want to describe n qubits, right? Because the state of a single qubit is described by two modes, and there's one photon somewhere in those two modes. And we could, you know, have superpositions, but we only have one photon somewhere in the two modes. So if we do this to represent n qubits, we'll have two n modes, so just a linear number of modes. That sounds quite reasonable. And we'll only need to have n photons, so again, just a linear number of photons. So that's much better than the exponential number of photons that we would need for the kind of, you know, very naive encoding using only one. Does that help? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so now we've described some kind of an encoding. So this is how we encode one qubit, and then we just repeat this many times if we want to encode many qubits. So, you know, the next thing we need to see is how we would initialize qubits to a pure state. So, you know, we would like to create the logical all zero state. And what that would mean would be that we would want to, you know, have our two n modes, and in some of them we would want to have no photon, and in some of them we would want to have exactly one photon. So what that means is that we need to have a source of single photons. So we need to have some device we can build that will allow us to create single photons. And this is quite a difficult thing to do experimentally, I'm told. I have not tried to do it myself, but I'm told that this is hard. And it's really quite challenging to do this in a reliable way. But there is a way that you can do this, at least to create the photons not in an on-demand way, but in a sort of a heralded way, where you have some process that when it succeeds, it creates a single photon, and then it tells you that it created a single photon. And that's using a process which is called parametric down conversion. So to create single photons, what we can do is we can use parametric down conversion. And here's how this works. So you have some piece of material which has which is some kind of a crystal, and it has the property that it's going to mediate interactions between photons. Right? So it's hard to get photons to interact with each other directly because they don't have any charge. But you can get them to interact in some way, you know, that's mediated by some medium, and you could build some kind of a material that's what's called a nonlinear crystal that would mediate interactions between photons. And then what you can do is you can shine a laser at such a thing, and if you send in some photon, there will be some possibility that the photon that you send in will split into two outgoing photons. So there'll be some amplitude for this to happen. So this will happen some of the time. And now, if you send in, photons described by a wave number k, well, then there'll be this process where it will split into two outgoing photons, and they'll be described by some wave numbers k1 and k2. And momentum is conserved, so k has to equal k1 plus k2. So now here's what you can do. So you put a detector over here. Now we have to talk about photodetectors also. We'll have to talk about this when we talk about measurement. But for now, let's just imagine we can build some kind of a device which detects when a photon hits it. So what we'll do is we'll put some photodetector over here. So there's some lead coming out of it so that you get some signal that's amplified by some piece of electronics. So when a photon hits this detector, it will create a click in some piece of apparatus. And then you know when this happens, when you detected a photon with momentum k1, you know the wave number of the other photon, right? So because you have this relation, if you put this detector in a particular place, you can figure out what the wave number of the other outgoing photon would be, and then you know that when you got a click in this detector, you got some photon of some desired wave number over here. And what we can do is we can use this single photon. And this is the way that single photon states are often created in experiments. And as I said, this is not something that you can necessarily do on demand because the amplitude for this process to happen is actually quite weak. And this is going to be a problem when we talk about the way we implement gates later on. But when this happens, you get this click, and then you know that you had this other photon. And then you can route this thing in some optical fiber or something like that, and you can use it later on in your experiment, and this is your single photon state. So this is at least a way that we could think about doing the initialization of the qubits for some optical implementation. Okay, yes?
So for this, we need to know the initial momentum?
Yes, but that's fine, because usually you have some laser, and there's some... It has some fixed frequency, and so you know what this initial k is.
But then there's also one photon per.
No, so what comes out of a laser is typically described by a coherent state. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a coherent state that's the output, which consists of a superposition over many different possible number states with some kind of Poisson distribution. You can turn down the amplitude of that source so that typically what's coming out here is often a single photon, but if you sort of just used a weak coherent source, that would not really be the same thing as having a single photon. But then when you happen to have a single photon coming out, and then this process occurs, then you kind of really know that this thing is a single photon. At least that's the idea. I'm sketching this in a very rough and hand wavy way, and I'm not a quantum optician, but I'm trying to kind of convey the flavor of how I think this works. Good. Other questions? Okay. Yes. Was there a person in particular who proposed this? Of course, people have. Well, we haven't said yet what's nonlinear about it, but this whole scheme, the idea of implementing this, the first paper that I'm aware of that kind of proposed this idea was by Chuang and Yamamoto. But there are, you know, certainly many papers about kind of this idea. But as I say, it's not something that really people have followed up on in practice a lot because, I mean, there are problems. I mean, basically the difficulty is that it's hard to do the two-qubit gates in this scheme, and we'll see that later on. Basically, because the way these gates will be done will be, again, to use these nonlinear crystals, and the interaction is very weak, and it's just hard to make it strong. So, and we're coming to that. Okay, so now we've talked a little bit about initialization, so now we want to see how to do gates. So to do gates, to do single-qubit gates, it'll suffice to use linear optical operations. So you know, given the encoding that we've chosen, so this dual rail encoding where we represent our logical states using two modes with one photon in one of the two modes, we can do single qubit gates by linear optics. And we can actually do a universal set of single qubit gates using only linear optics. So the first kind of linear optical tool that we might use to do this. So by the way, when I say linear optics, what I mean is evolutions which will implement linear transformations on the creation and annihilation operator. Like if you think in the Heisenberg picture where the operators are evolving. So this would be operations that implement linear transformations on the mode operators. So we have, you know, A dagger, then we'll have some other modes, B dagger, etc. Okay, so the first kind of simple linear optical element that we might use in order to perform some kind of a gate would be what's called a phase shifter. And by this, what I mean is basically, you know, you've got some beam of light coming in, and then you just put in a slab of some kind of transparent material, like say glass, which has a different index of refraction than the air. And so what's going to happen when you do this is that the phase of the light will rotate at a different rate when it's passing through the material with a different index of refraction, and then you would get a relative phase relative to some other path where you didn't stick in the piece of glass. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, which will describe the dynamics in such a situation. If you think about this mode, so say the light here is described by a mode described by annihilation operator A. The Hamiltonian will basically just be, you know, this is the Hamiltonian of free evolution, but you have a different frequency when you're passing through a different medium. So this is just the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator, right? So this is just like omega A dagger A. I mean, let me forget about the kind of, zero-point term. Forget about the kind of shift by the identity because, that just affects everything the same. So, but we have some different frequency when we're passing through this different medium, and that's described by this frequency omega. I'm just setting h bar equal to 1. Okay, so now what's going to happen if we evolve with this kind of a Hamiltonian acting on a single mode? So then we have, evolution, which will be given by e to the minus iht acting on whatever is, say, the number state n. So we think about evolving some particular number state n. And of course, this is just e to the minus I times, n times omega t times the number state n. Right? So if this is the zero state, then it's unaffected, right? Because then we just get a phase of 1. But if we have a single photon in that mode, then we get some relative phase. So here we get e to the minus I omega t. Right. And we don't have to worry, times 1, of course. And we don't have to worry about what happens if we have two or more photons because that's not part of our logical, subspace. We're going to try to stay out of the subspace where we have more than one photon in any given mode. So this by itself actually already looks like a rotation about the z-axis of the Bloch sphere, right? Because this is something where, this is basically described by some diagonal matrix, 1, 0, 0, e to the minus I omega t. So So this is exactly a Z rotation. Okay, but this is not a Z rotation in the logical subspace. This is a Z rotation of a single mode, but that's not the way we're encoding information, right? We're encoding information using a pair of modes. So we either have our photon here, or we have our photon here, or we have any superposition. So what we actually need to see is how things evolve, you know, when we consider the two possible states, 0, 1 and 1, 0 of the two modes. But it's basically exactly the same thing. So let's just kind of quickly see that. So here we have our logical states. So if we're in the 0, 1 logical state, well, then we're in the situation where, you know, 0 evolves to 0, and, you know, here we're applying the identity. You know, we're just thinking about the relative phase that's acquired due to the presence of this little piece of glass. So now we have, you know, no relative phase which is applied, so this thing is going to just evolve into 0, 1. Okay, but on the other hand, if we're in the 1, 0 state, then we're really, you know, really in this situation for the top mode, and so this is what's going to happen. So we're going to get, again, e to the minus I omega t, 1, 0. So it's really exactly the same thing when we consider the actual logical states that we care about. Okay? So what that says is that this implements a logical Z rotation. And by choosing, you know, the thickness of this piece of material, we can implement any rotation about the z-axis by any angle that we might like. Okay. Yes.
Why doesn't the phase shifter affect the other mode?
Well, because there isn't one there. There's no piece of glass here, right? That we just put it in the first mode. So this is our, you know, this is some B mode, but we didn't sort of worry about what happened there because, you know, we didn't put in anything in, so it's just acting as the identity.
So it's physically separated.
It's physically separated, right? You could think about these modes as, I mean, so the modes could be different things, right? They could be the, you know, horizontal and vertical polarizations of a single photon, say. That would be a way to implement this kind of encoding. And then it would be a problem, maybe, because they would be in the same place. But if you thought about them as being, you know, maybe we always use the horizontal polarization, and we have the photon in one of two places, or we have superpositions of those two places, then we can do something like this. If you wanted to use polarization, then you would have to have some, you know, maybe you could use a polarization-dependent beam splitter and then route them back together, but that would probably be harder. But I don't actually go into the lab and, you know, twiddle knobs, so I don't actually know. But what I have in mind is that they're you know, separate modes, like just spatially distinct modes. Okay, good. So this is good because it allows us to do rotations about the z-axis by any angle we like, but of course that's not going to give us a universal set of gates because, you know, actually if we just prepare computational basis states and then we do z rotations, and then measure, nothing interesting happens, right? We always stay in the all zero state. So that would be definitely not enough. So we would also like to be able to do rotations about some other axis. And we can do that using another simple linear optical element, which is a beam splitter. So what is a beam splitter? So a beam splitter is, you know, some kind of a piece of, well, glass again, but you know, deposit a little bit of something reflective on one side of it, say you deposit a little bit of silver, but not so much that it would completely reflect all of the light, so the thing is still somewhat transparent. So now what's going to happen is you're going to have, well, if you have here some A mode that could come, that could be, you know, impinging on the beam splitter, you know, we could describe what happens when the light passes straight through as, you know, we think of that as still the same mode. And then we could have some other mode coming in. So we could have light coming in the B mode. And it could go straight through. OK, but we can also have reflection. So we also have some possibility that the photon comes in the A mode and reflects into the B mode. Or it could come in the B mode and it could reflect into the A mode. OK? So, you know, as in the case of the phase shifter, we can describe this by some Hamiltonian dynamics. And those dynamics are the following. So the Hamiltonian is just some coupling constant. I don't know, let me call it lambda times A dagger B plus A B dagger. Okay, so this is some kind of a term which will allow you to, you know, of course there's some possibility to go straight through, and that's described by, you know, not acting with the Hamiltonian. But you know, here we have a term where we can take a photon out of the A mode and put it into the B mode, or we could take it out of the B mode and put it into the A mode. And so, you know, it can also do this on states involving many photons, but we're only going to care about the action on states where we have zero or one photon in the two modes, actually where we have no photon in one mode and one photon in the other mode. So, you know, only on these logical states. Okay, and it's quite easy to see that this evolution will actually generate X rotations if we think about the action on the logical states. So let's quickly see that. So if we have A dagger B plus A B dagger acting on the logical state 0, 1, so corresponding to the state 0, 1, which corresponds to the logical state 0, then so what this term is going to do is create a photon in the first mode and destroy a photon in the second mode. So it's this kind of number-preserving operation. So that's going to map this to 1, 0. And then the second term does nothing. It just maps this to 0 because you can't take out a photon if you don't have any. And then, you know, we can also think about what happens if we act on the 1, 0 state. And unsurprisingly, for exactly the same reason, we're going to get the state 0, 1, because this thing is symmetric under exchanging the two modes. Okay, so this is the action of the Hamiltonian. This is what happens when we act with, I wrote maps 2, but I really meant to write equals because I actually acted with the thing on the left. Okay, good. So this is the action of this thing in the subspace that we care about, and we see that the computational subspace is an invariant subspace of this Hamiltonian. So actually, if we evolve with this Hamiltonian for any amount of time, we'll stay within the logical subspace, so that's good. We preserve our encoding. And what it does is exactly an X operation, right? So this is a logical poly X. Because it maps the logical 0 state to the logical 1 state, and the logical 1 state to the logical 0 state. So if we evolve with this Hamiltonian, if we consider solving Schrodinger's equation, where we evolve for time t, it's going to give us some rotation about the x-axis. And that will allow us to perform a rotation by any angle. Of course, to get rotations by different angles, we would have to get effectively different values of lambda times t, which would correspond to depositing different amounts of silver on the mirror, and maybe having different conventions also for the phase at which the light comes in. Okay, but by varying some kind of simple parameters that you can in principle vary in an experiment, you can use this to generate rotations by different angles about the x-axis. And so by combining these two things, you can actually get a universal set of gates consisting of some rotations about the z-axis and some rotations about the x-axis by angles that are enough to allow you to get a universal set. Okay. This is only single qubit gates, and of course we also have to be able to implement interactions. Oh, yes.
How do we know whether the spinner acted on the state or not? So, as you say, there's a chance of just going through.
Right.
But don't we know which of the two happens?
Well, we don't want to know. I mean, we want to, you know, have the possibility of evolving, say, basis states into superpositions, and we don't want to. We want everything to stay coherent, right? So if we had some flag in the environment that said, oh, you know, this went to here, then that would be describing some decoherence process, which would prevent the computer from operating. So it's kind of crucial that we don't know which happened.
So we don't want to be sure that whether we did a rotation or not.
No, we want to know that we did the rotation, but we don't want to know. Say the goal is to prepare a plus state, right? So we send in a logical zero state, which corresponds to definitely sending in the photon along this mode. And we want the output to be a plus state. So we want it to be a uniform superposition of the photon going out here with amplitude 1 over root 2 and going out here with amplitude 1 over root 2. And we would not like to resolve, we would not like to distinguish between those two possibilities of the photon coming out here and the photon coming out here. But we want to know that the gate was done, and we'll know that was the case if we wait for the right amount of time. I mean, we know the speed of light, and the only possibilities of a photon comes in this idealized picture are that the photon comes out here or that it comes out here. And so if you wait for the right amount of time, you know exactly where the photon is. I mean, you know, there's an uncertainty principle too, but basically if you wait for the right amount of time, you know, you can know where the photon has come out, and so you'll know that it's either here or in some superposition of those two places. Is that kind of okay? Okay, we can also talk about it afterwards. Other questions? Okay. So the next thing we have to be able to do is the interactions, and as I said, this is a difficult thing. And you know, to do this, what you can basically do is try to cause two modes to interact using one of these nonlinear crystals. So this thing is working exactly by mediating interactions between photons. And there's some kind of a description of the sort of interaction that you get if you build one of these things. And to really understand this in detail, you know, you have to go into the microscopic atomic physics of how exactly this thing works and how the photons interact with the, you know, the electrons in the crystal, which we will not do now. But I can just write down for you at least what the Hamiltonian looks like in terms of the kinds of interactions that you see. So for interactions, we're going to again use a nonlinear crystal. And this will be described by some Hamiltonian, which is, again, some coupling constant, times operators that look like A dagger A, B dagger B. So, you know, I'm just saying that if you kind of do the relevant atomic physics, you can say that there's you know, some medium which will mediate interactions between light that's described by this Hamiltonian. So, you know, for now you have to just sort of take that on faith. But what I can say is that if you could build some system which was described by this Hamiltonian, then this would allow you to implement interactions between qubits. So how is that? Well, let's see what happens if we act with H, or let's just say if we act with this operator, so A dagger A, B dagger B, on the different possible basis states. So you know, now we're talking about interactions between qubits. So we're going to have four modes, right? Because each qubit corresponds to two modes. And so I really want to think about you know, these A and B operators corresponding to two of the modes out of the four. Right, so when we have two modes out of the four, we have the possibility of being in states like 0, 0, or 1, 1. Right? We know there are two photons in total, but those two photons could be distributed in various different ways across the four modes. And so we'll be looking at two modes out of the four such that, you know, well, two modes where one of the modes comes from each of the logical qubits. So we'll have to worry about what happens when we have states like 0, 0. Well, but of course, if we have the 0, 0 state, we just get zero, right? And similarly, if we have zero photons in either of the modes, actually, we'll get just zero. This operator will just annihilate the state. So these are not the logical states, but they're you know, I'm taking one of the modes from each of two from the logical states of each of two qubits. So ultimately, we're going to put this thing together in a system that involves four modes. This is why I have the possibility of states like 0, 0. Let me just you know, finish this, and then we'll see how we actually use this thing. Okay, but the other possibility is that we have you know, we have one photon in both of the modes, and then we just get back 1, 1, right? Because this is just the product of the number operators for the two modes. So if we have one photon in each mode, then we actually get 1, 1. So this Hamiltonian is going to generate some dynamics where no phase is acquired for these states, but some phase is acquired for the logical 1, 1 state. Right. So now what you can imagine is, you know, suppose we have our four modes, right? So this is qubit 1, and this is qubit 2. And then what we're going to do is we're going to use this Kerr Hamiltonian, this Hamiltonian of the nonlinear medium, for, say, you know, this mode and this mode. So interact these modes with you know, H equals chi A dagger A, B dagger B for some amount of time. And now if you look at the logical states where you're in the logic, you know, any state other than the logical 1-1 state, so now I'm not talking about this 1-1, but I'm talking about the logical 1-1 state up here, for any of those states, there'll be no photon in one or the other of these two modes. Okay, so no phase will be acquired when we do this evolution. But on the other hand, if we're in the logical 1-1 state, that will correspond to this mode being in the state 0, this one being in the state 1. This is how we get 1 here. And here we're going to have, oh, sorry, I guess I said the logical 1 state was 1-0. So sorry about that. So I guess I want to interact these two modes. So if I'm in the logical one state, then I have one photon here, no photons here, one photon here, and no photons here, and then some phase will be acquired when I do the evolution. Right? So then the action on the logical states will be as follows. So if I have, 0, 1, 0, 1, this will just map to 0, 1, 0, 1. If I have 0, 1, 1, 0, this will just map to 0, 1, 1, 0. If I have 1, 0, 0, 1, this will just map to 1, 0, 0, 1. So I'm writing down all of the possible states that would encode two qubits, the basis states. But the last possibility is the logical 1, 1 state, and this is described by the state of the four modes, which is 1, 0, 1, 0. And this here will acquire some phase. So we'll get some e to the minus I times chi times t, 1, 0, 1, 0. Yes?
Why is that labeled logical state evolution involves?
So this is the logical state. This is the 0, 0 logical state. I could write it like that, right? So this is the state describing the 0, 0 logical state. This is the 0, 1 logical state, et cetera. So, I don't care, for example, how the state 1, 1, 7, 17 would evolve, because that's not describing a logical state. Does that make sense? Okay, so if we consider this evolution, what is the gate which is applied on the logical states? Well, we only care about the subspace, which is spanned by these four states. And the gate is the following. So it's 1, 1, 1, e to the minus I, chi, t. And again, this, chi is some parameter that you can adjust. And maybe t is some parameter you can adjust. So you can make this phase be different things. And then all of the other elements in this unitary matrix are 0. So in other words, it's a diagonal unitary operation where you have a phase which is applied only to the 1, 1 state. Okay. And now what I claim is that this kind of operation, except of course for some maybe poor choices of values of chi, like for example chi equals 0 would not be so interesting because you would just get the identity operation. But if you make basically any interesting choice for this phase, this is a gate which, when you combine it with single qubit gates, will give you a universal set. Okay, so this gives, or generically gives, a universal set when combined with single qubit gates. So, the way to think about this is that you should imagine that this is a controlled rotation about the z-axis. So say if the first qubit is in the 0 state, we do the identity. If the first qubit is in the 1 state, we do some z-rotation. And you're going to see a problem on the next tutorial where you see that if you have controlled rotations about the z-axis, then if you perform some change of basis, which could be implemented just by single qubit gates, then you can think about that as a controlled rotation about the x-axis. And so you could effectively do a CNOT gate if you have the ability to do something like this. So being able to do something like this is really quite closely related to being able to do a CNOT. And if you can do this, now you have a universal set of gates. Okay. So the problem with all of this, and we would have to then next talk about the last thing, which is like the so we have to be able to do measurements, and maybe just take my word for it that you can build photodetectors. It's quite hard to build photodetectors that can resolve single photons, but in principle you could try to do it. And then eventually we would have to talk about gate operation times. But there's kind of a more fundamental problem that stops this implementation from being really practical, which is that these optical nonlinearities are extremely weak. So sort of the parameter chi that you could realistically realize in the laboratory in the laboratory would be very small. So it's hard to make chi big. It's hard to get photons to interact in this way. And so you know, these interactions are extremely weak, and it's quite difficult to use this to then to make a realistic quantum computer which has strong interactions. I mean, effectively, what this means is that the gate operation time would be very long, and so we would not be able to do many gates in a computer that was built this way. So there are alternative proposals for doing quantum computation optically. It turns out that an alternative to being able to do these kinds of interactions is to be able to measure the qubits in specific states. So you have some number resolving detector, and then to be able to do linear optics later on in the computation, where the choice of what linear optical elements you do is conditioned on the measurement results that you saw. So if you can do these adaptive linear optical operations depending on the measurements that you saw, this actually is enough to realize universal quantum computation without having to build this, without having to use one of these nonlinear crystals to directly implement interactions. So this is something which is called the KLM proposal. And this is one promising possible way to try to build quantum computers. And I think you're going to see something on the next, on the first assignment where you look at what's called gate teleportation, which is very closely related to this idea of doing operations using measurement and post-selection. So this is you know, one possible way to kind of fix up this problem with this scheme. So the other thing that I wanted to do was kind of give a quick review of some of the you know, major implementations. But I think we're out of time. So probably what I'll do is just say something about this very briefly next time. And then the bulk of the next lecture will be about computational complexity, which will be a lead into talking about algorithms. So any last questions? OK, great. So see you tomorrow.